Go on, gal, don't take me for no fool. I ain't gonna quit your pretty mama while the weather's cool. Around your back.
Futurists are looking at the 21st century.
And all myths that are authentic maintain a kind of dreamlike, surreal quality.
Computers are taking over now.
By the year 2001, man will travel about in pneumatic people tubes.
It's time once again to step into the future.
If you ever were the devil's boss without any harness, better burn your man. I hear you, mama.
Heyo, I'm still alive. It's been a while, hasn't it? Yeah, sorry about that. We're about 11 weeks into 2024 as I'm recording this episode. I'm not sure exactly when it will actually come out. And I've already crammed as much into these first 11 weeks as I typically do in an entire year. So things have been a little crazy around here of late. Here's what I've done in 2024 so far. I totally rewrote the entire manuscript for The Ended World, which is the new and improved title I settled on for the book formerly known as The Vigilance, aka the AI novel, the one I was working on all last year. So yeah, that's how my process works. I can spend more or less a whole ass year writing a book and then totally redo the entire manuscript in like 3 weeks. And then I parted ways with my last agent because I didn't think she was the right one to represent this book, and I have gone back to querying looking for a new agent. And let me tell you, what a totally different experience querying is when you're already a best-selling author with a strong sales track and you've shortlisted for a few awards. It is a whole different ballgame when you have a career already compared to what it was like as a new author just kind of going out there hat in hand being like, please find some merit in my work, please. I've been focusing solely on agents who have a very good reputation in literary fiction and who have had recent high dollar sales and who represent some of the biggest authors in my genre, and the response has been extremely encouraging. When you are querying, the general rule is to say as little as possible about how it's going, because agents do check stuff like social media and podcasts to get a feel for what you're like as a person, like what kind of client you might be, and the less information you can give them about how your search for an agent is going, the more power you tend to have in the whole scenario. So I'm not going to give any details about how this process has been going for me until after I've signed with my new agent, whoever that ends up being. But I will say that, based on the speed and enthusiasm I have seen in responses from so many very experienced agents with such impressive client lists, I'm feeling optimistic about how The Ended World might strike the market and what could potentially happen for this book when it goes out on sub to publishers. So, cheers! It's always nice to feel some optimism about one's career because writing novels is the kind of career where you don't find many causes for optimism all that often. So anyway, that happened and it's going well. And then I rewrote the entire manuscript for my next Olivia Hawker novel, which is called The Stars and Their Light. That's the one that's about the Roswell flying saucer crash in 1947. I know I've kind of mentioned it a little bit on the show before, but like it's also about so much more than that. And while I was rewriting The Stars and Their Light, I got COVID! Hey-o! My first time getting COVID, y'all. She finally found me after 4 years. Thank goodness for the vaccines because it wasn't too bad. And I think it would have been pretty damn bad if I didn't already have some antibodies built up. I felt icky for 2 days and then basically fine, except I was tired and had to take a lot of naps for like a week. Oh, and I lost my sense of taste and smell for a week, which sucked, but it wasn't, you know, it was okay. But I have asthma, so the inflammation caused my airways to freak out, and I had the most god-awful cough for like almost 3 straight weeks. That part really sucked because I have been waiting for 3 years for Dune Part 2 to come out. As I believe I have mentioned on this podcast before, probably a few times, I am the world's biggest Dune nerd. And opening weekend was when I got COVID. So I was just like lying miserably in my bed going, oh, I could be watching Dune right now. So I had to wait all this time for my cough to subside before I could go see this movie. Because seriously, the cough was so bad that other people were alarmed by it. Like, I was hacking so violently that I looked like I was about to die. And honestly, I felt like I was gonna break a rib from it, or like my temples were gonna explode from the pressure every time I cough. And to be honest, I did pee a little every time I coughed, because that's the fun part of being a middle-aged woman. Shout out to all my lady friends out there who have gone through similar things from COVID and from other issues. It's just, you know, it happens once you reach a certain age. But anyway, my cough is a lot better now. It's still kind of hanging around, but not to the point where it's gonna frighten other people and make them think I'm about to infect them with COVID. And I just recently, finally, got to see Dune Part 2, and it was fucking awesome. And the movie reminded me of how really special Dune is as a cultural phenomenon, as an idea. And that's what I'm gonna talk about in this episode. Dune, the cultural force. Dune, as an entity, and the way ideas can become so much bigger and so much more powerful, so much more autonomous than the people who originate them. It's a fascinating concept broadly, but looking at the history of Dune specifically and its attempts to be adapted from book into a good film, a quality film that does its job well, Dune is a really good way to explore the concept of an egregore in depth. Anyway, this is Future Saint of a New Era, and I'm Libby Grant. I just used a word you're probably not familiar with. Egregore. What the hell is that? Egregore is a term that's commonly used among people who study or are otherwise interested in esoterica, which is more or less the hidden or underground aspect of otherwise mainstream topics. Like, there's an esoteric side to science, where you'll get people or organizations like the Institute of Noetic Sciences or the CIA who study some of the funnier aspects of natural phenomena that don't necessarily line up with the rest of the laws that science has been able to tease out of its careful observations of nature. There's an esoteric side to religion, where you have the mainstream ways various religions are practiced, and then you have these offshoot branches that have a very different take on the religion compared to the mainstream. And Gnostic Christianity is a pretty good example there. Most people in Western society are fairly familiar with the basic features shared by most mainstream Christian denominations, even if you're not actually Christian yourself. But Gnosticism is this totally different take on the concept of Christianity that's poorly understood by the culture at large and is really only of interest to a specialized subset of nerds. Nerds who get way more into it than regular people do. That's really what defines the esoteric, whether you're talking about sciences or religion or academia. Esoterica is the word for the little nitty-gritty details that hardcore devotees get way into. And as you have no doubt gathered from previous episodes of my podcast, I love esoterica. I'm fascinated by these kind of hidden histories of otherwise mundane topics, the stories below the stories that influence the psychology of people who take action in science or in religion or in whatever other field you're looking at. So within the realms of the esoteric, egregore is a pretty common word, but you don't hear it often in the mainstream. And the concept of what an egregore actually is can be pretty hard to wrap your head around at first. But I found that the history of Dune is the perfect way to illustrate the concept of an egregore for all you squares out there who aren't so aware of the esoteric side of life. First, before I go into full-on dork mode on you, a simple definition of the word. It's an obscure enough word among the mainstream population that it hasn't yet found its way into any dictionary, but the definition in Wikipedia is pretty good. An egregore is a non-physical entity that arises from the collective thoughts and emotions of a distinctive group of individuals. It's also called a thought form, which is all one word, And certain cultures have their own words for this concept. In the West, more people are probably familiar with the Tibetan Buddhist concept of a tulpa than with any other culture's take on the concept of an egregore. So in the most basic literal terms, that's what we're talking about today. Collective thoughts that arise from distinctive groups of people and amass themselves into non-physical entities. In other words, ideas that become autonomous, that seem to take on a will of their own and begin shaping the world to suit their own purposes. And these purposes are independent of any individual human, including the individual who originated that particular idea. I know it's a weird concept. I know it's probably not in line with the way you view reality, and that's fine. I know that the way I conceive of reality and interact with reality is very different from how most of you do those things, and I respect that. It's fine with me. I know the fact that I've got a very different approach to things makes some of you out there uncomfortable. Anytime I mention my spiritual beliefs and my spiritual practices on this podcast, I always lose a couple of subscribers because it's just too uncomfortable for some people to open themselves up to the potential that a not strictly materialist reality might exist and might be all around them at this very moment. So I don't hold it against anybody. I'm too spooky for a lot of people, and that's okay. I'm also not trying to convince anyone that my ideas are correct. I don't think there even is such a thing as objectively correct ideas. I'm just sharing my thoughts about stuff, and you know, if you find something useful in what I say, great, and if you don't, that's fine with me too, but I hope you were at least entertained for an hour. I will say that I was once also a hardcore atheist and a hardcore materialist, and now I'm not. Things change. Hopefully, if you're doing life right, you're always learning and experiencing new things and readjusting your ideas as you get more information. And sometimes our thoughts about and experiences with reality change over time too. And as long as we're living positive, fulfilling lives, and having good relationships with other people, and making good art and not hurting anyone, then who really cares what somebody thinks about the mechanisms of reality or about anything else? So this is all just to say that I know this topic is going to be a bit of a wild ride for some of you, but rest assured, I'm not trying to make you believe in any of this stuff. I'm just going to tell you a fascinating story about a story, and about the surprising effect it has had on the world for many decades since its first appearance.
Put your right hand in the box.
Most of you are probably pretty familiar with Dune in the most basic sense. I'm sure a lot of my listeners have seen the two recent films by now, the ones made by Denis Villeneuve. They have been big blockbusters with good reason. They are absolutely awesome. For those who aren't familiar, I'll give a cursory overview of the plot, because the story itself is not what we're talking about today. But in as small a nutshell as I can manage, Dune is a science fiction story set in a possible distant future, about 20,000-ish years from now, when humanity has spread far beyond Earth to colonize many other planets in our general galactic neighborhood. Despite the fact that tens of thousands of years have passed and humanity is spread out among many solar systems, depressingly little has changed about how humanity orders and governs itself compared to right now. The authoritarian rule of a single ultimate power, in this case a galactic emperor, is at the top of this pyramid of power, with several noble houses under the emperor, each house holding power over its own planet. Some of these nobles are relatively less fascistic than others, but ultimately you still have this feudal state, where there's one great source of strength and governance at the top, with decreasing power as you travel down the pyramid to all the ordinary schmoes who are basically just there to work and enrich the nobles and the emperor. And then there's this incredibly powerful trade organization, a corporation that has full control over how wealth and other resources pass among all these planets ruled by all these noble families. So you've got authoritarianism and capitalism still in complete control of the lives and fates of ordinary humans. Notably, for a science fiction novel, there's very little technology in the world of Dune, and most of the technology that exists is in the form of mechanics, like machines used for getting around or for harvesting resources. There are almost no computers because of a past event in which artificial intelligence proved itself to be potentially dangerous to humanity, so humanity has outlawed the use of all but the most simplistic forms of computer. There's one device that's basically like an e-reader, like a Kindle, but that's about as computerish as anything in Dune gets. But it still takes a lot of data analysis to handle stuff like interstellar spaceflight and the intricate juggling of all these complex economic interactions among planets. So rather than thinking machines, humanity has nurtured a certain class of human called mentats who can rapidly process enormous amounts of data the way a computer might do. So the mentats are basically a priest class that works hand in hand with the noble class. They have control over critical information, and only the wealthy can afford to employ a mentat, so only the wealthy have access to the most critical information about how this society functions and how to manipulate it. The feudal class, the everyday underlings like you and me, are cut off from knowledge, wealth, and power. And to make matters worse, there's an additional organization called the Bene Gesserit who are kind of playing their own power game among this landscape. The Bene Gesserit are an analogy for organized religion in our real world. They do things like intentionally seeding certain myths into various cultures on various planets, which members of their own organization can later use for their personal benefit, manipulating entire populations with relative ease, and generally building up their own power via the psychological and spiritual manipulations they inflict on this massive population of oppressed serfs who exist on every planet throughout the colonized galaxy. Cheerful, isn't it? So against this political backdrop, the actual story of Dune, the drama of Dune, follows the conflict between two great houses, Atreides and Harkonnen, who are vying for control of a planet, which the Empire calls Dune because it's mostly desert. It's just this huge ball of sand, but which its native inhabitants call Arrakis. Arrakis has such a harsh, hellish environment that it would be written off as a useless backwater, except that it's the only place in the entire galaxy where a certain resource can be found, called the spice. It's never made super clear in the books, and even less so in the films, what exactly the spice is. The books come the closest to explaining spice, but they leave a lot to the imagination too. All you really know, and all anyone really needs to know, is that spice can only be found on Arrakis, that all attempts to create synthetic spice have not worked out very well, and spice is absolutely vital to interplanetary trade, because when a mentat, those human computer guys, consumes enough spice, they become a new form of entity called a navigator, and only navigators have the mental ability to open wormholes through space, which in turn facilitates trade among all these widely separated planets. So in a setting with very limited technology, the entire economy of this galactic empire depends on these navigators using this substance called spice, and without spice, everything collapses. The empire, the power structure that supports the existence of the mentats and the Bene Gesserit, all those noble houses, they become pointless kings sitting on heaps of isolated rock, stranded in their own solar systems. And the very concept of empire itself goes bye-bye. Capitalism keeps empire, organized religion, and the priestly control of information all afloat, and the only thing that keeps capitalism afloat is the spice that is harvested on the planet Arrakis. So, this conflict between these two noble houses, the Atreides and the Harkonnens, is extremely high stakes. Obviously, whoever ultimately controls Arrakis will control all of these incredibly powerful ideas, these incredibly powerful entities that still hold sway over the fates of all human beings 20,000 years into the future. And yes, spice is a very obvious metaphor for oil. Frank Herbert, who wrote the novel Dune, was very intentionally creating an allegory about the power structures that existed in the middle of the 20th century when he wrote the book, and still exist to this day. And you can't tell that story without finding some way to talk about fossil fuels and the critical role they play in our economy and how that oil-centric economy props up power structures around the globe. So yeah, if you are getting oil vibes from the spice, that's on purpose. That's what Frank wanted you to get. So the key members of these two noble houses fight for control of Arrakis, shit gets wild, and two of them end up fleeing into the deep desert where they throw themselves on the mercy of the indigenous population, a culture called the Fremen. These two key characters are a teenage boy named Paul Atreides, who's the son of the recently murdered Duke Leto Atreides, and Paul's mother, Lady Jessica, who was Leto's concubine and who is herself a Bene Gesserit. As a Bene Gesserit, she was carefully trained in how to use the seeded religious myths to her advantage, and she has a number of other powers that come from intense psychological training all the Bene Gesserit receive, And in turn, she has taught these techniques to her son, Paul, even though traditionally, all Bene Gesserit are women. So primarily through the perspectives of Paul and Jessica, Dune is an examination of how political and economic power is leveraged, how it changes hands, how it corrupts, and how the exploitation of human beings in the name of capitalism and empire leads to radicalization and terrorism. In that regard, it's an incredibly important story to help a modern reader understand the power structures that are currently oppressing them, you, and to help modern readers contextualize many of the biggest political and social issues that are playing out on a global scale all around us. Dune was originally written in the early 1960s and was first published in part as a serial in Analog magazine in 1963 and 64. In 65, it was first published as a complete novel. Depressingly, in the 60 years that have elapsed since then, it has only grown more relevant, with a message that feels increasingly urgent with each passing year. And here's where the episode starts to get a little weird. Here's where we get into the esoterica of Dune.
Listen to me. The spice must flow. The spice has given me accelerated evolution.
Dune, the novel, is the best-selling work of science fiction of all time. And with good reason. It is an extraordinary book, unlike anything else I've read in structure and theme. And although I don't really have a favorite book because I love too many to pick a favorite, Dune is somewhere in my top five. Frank Herbert was not a master of craft. His character work leaves a little something to be desired, and he pays no attention to perspective. But even so, the ideas in Dune are so big and so relevant and so powerfully explored that it just grabs hold of you and it doesn't let go. Despite its flaws, which probably would only even be noticed by other novelists who spend all their time thinking about storytelling craft, Dune remains, after six decades, the kind of original and potent novel that reshapes cultural ideas of what a novel can be. And it certainly did that during its own time. It reshaped the public's ideas about the purpose of story and the purpose of science fiction, which up until that time had been mostly thought of as pop culture fluff or pulpy entertainment by the culture at large, by everyone who was not inside the sci-fi fandom. Dune was very much a part of the broader changes that were taking place in art at that time across many fields of art making, including visual art, theater, and music. You guys know I'm way nerdy about art history. I'm way nerdy about everything I talk about on this podcast. And Dune is really the child of the decadent art movement of the Victorian era, which sought to criticize the way society was rigidly and homogeneously run. The decadent movement gave way to a sort of deconstructivist and populist era across all the art forms, and was directly responsible for the rise of the modernist literature movement in the early 20th century, where traditional forms were intentionally broken, where the structure and function of society was openly examined and criticized, something that was streng verboten in the late 19th century, and where technology really began to be incorporated into storytelling in very deliberate and symbolic ways. And it wasn't just literature that was going through this cataclysmic shift in the early 20th century. As any Western art history major will tell you, the first half of the 20th century was a remarkably fertile time, with many new movements erupting into the public eye and flourishing in music, in visual art, in literature, and entirely new kinds of art were being born. This is where we see film emerging as an art form and photography really developing beyond portraits and landscapes into a means of creating expressive art, rather than just, you know, a cool new technology that only historians or portrait makers were using to document facts. Frank Herbert was born in 1920 in Tacoma, Washington. Shout out to the Pacific Northwest, where all the greatest artists hail from. And he grew up in this soup of radically shifting art. And emphasis on that word, radical, the condition of the art world was, as ever, a reflection of what was going on culturally among the actual populace, not at the higher governmental level where the powers that be were doing what powers that be always do, striving to maintain the status quo and thus to preserve themselves. But the same ideas that would soon blow up into major social movements like the civil rights movement, the sexual revolution, and a more organized and politically active form of feminism were all brewing among the everyday people of the West, and fed back into this incredible flourishing of countless new art movements that all normalized the criticism of tradition, of authority, and of power. And that's the cultural soup that young Frank's mind was cooked in. Now, he was born in Tacoma, but during the Great Depression, he left his parents, who were struggling financially, as so many people were during that time, and he moved to Salem, Oregon to live with his aunt. He finished out high school there, and by that time, he knew what he wanted to do with his life. He wanted to be a journalist. He'd had a lifelong love of reading, especially newspapers, and also a love for photography. So as soon as he'd finished high school, he lied about his age to land himself a position as a reporter and photojournalist for the local paper. Another shout out there, because as a teenager, I also lied about my age to start working earlier than I was legally permitted to do, but I was just a barista, which isn't nearly as cool as being a photojournalist during the lead up to World War II. Speaking of the war, Frank did serve in the Navy, but pretty quickly suffered a serious concussion and received a medical discharge. After his time with the Navy, Frank began to write short stories and sell them to magazines as a way of expanding his potential income as a writer. Always a good strategy, my fellow writers. Keep your eggs in as many baskets as you can manage, for sure. So he was doing a lot of various kinds of writing, but he hadn't yet had any serious thoughts about writing a novel, and certainly not a science fiction novel, when he took a journalistic assignment in Florence, Oregon, documenting an attempt by the State Department of Ecology to stabilize the huge, mobile sand dunes of the area by planting them with certain types of grasses. The concept of what was essentially terraforming captivated Frank, and the more he researched the ecology of dune environments, the faster his ideas about a potential sci-fi novel began to grow. He continued refining the ideas that would eventually become the novel Dune for a number of years, and during this time he played around in some earlier novels with some of the concepts that would become central to the story of Dune. Notably, in his 1955 novel The Dragon in the Sea, he got into the dangers of an economy that relied on a finite resource, oil, and he wrote about the future political conflicts over the diminishing supply of fossil fuels. But Dune itself wasn't ready to be born yet. The novel resisted Frank until he began paying attention to another radical new aspect of mid-20th century culture, psychedelics, which were gaining a lot more attention as they moved out of the realm of medicine and into the counterculture of the beat poets and the left-wing objectors to the Korean War. Frank Herbert's interest in psychedelics, which the mycologist Paul Stamets claims was one of personal experience, apparently Frank told Paul at some point that he had used psilocybin mushrooms and had found the experience to be significant in a number of ways, but his interest in psychedelics led Frank to a probing exploration of what consciousness is, and what minds are really capable of. And if you are familiar with Dune, whether you've read the books or you've seen the recent movies, you know that the question of what a mind can do under the right circumstances is explored pretty extensively in the story. This aspect of consciousness as active tool, not just an aspect of the self, but as something that is actively used and honed and even weaponized, seemed to be the puzzle piece that needed to click into place so that Dune could come together. Very soon after his interest in psychedelics began, Frank completed Dune, which was first published in serial format, as I mentioned, in 8 installments in the sci-fi magazine Analog. But when Frank tried to find a book publisher to take on the novel, he couldn't. 20 publishers rejected the work for a number of reasons, primarily because it was too different. It was so out there compared to what sci-fi was at the time, compared to what sci-fi had mostly been up until that point, which was mainly simple adventure stories set in space. This was something different entirely, a philosophical deep dive into important societal questions, and a story that involved a minimum of technology, a story that specifically and intentionally excluded most technology. This was not what sci-fi readers were into. It was also a very long work. Dune stands at about 187,000 words in length. If you're familiar with my own writing, One for the Blackbird, One for the Crow, which is my best-known book to date, is 185,000 words long, and it's a doorstopper. So Dune, although it was clearly brilliant and paradigm-breaking and presented an incredibly compelling story, was just too unusual for most publishers to get on board. At least one of them seemed to understand the power of Dune even as they turned it down. One editor wrote that he, quote, might be making the mistake of the decade, end quote, in rejecting the book for publication. My dude, you made the mistake of the century, in fact, because despite its strangeness, Despite its dissimilarity to what was popular in the genre at the time, Dune would very quickly become one of the most successful and most culturally influential works of fiction in the entire history of the printed word. Some stories are more than just stories. Some stories have a life of their own, and not even the traditions and authorities, not even the vast and precarious empire of the publishing industry itself, can prevent them from doing what they came here to do.
Father, the sleeper has awakened!
So who finally picked up Dune? Who looked past the rigid, authoritarian status quo of the way things are done in the publishing world and saw Dune for what it was and what it could be? A fellow by the name of Sterling Lanier, who was an editor at Chilton. Yes, Chilton. If you have ever worked on a car, you are familiar with Chilton. They did not publish novels when they acquired Dune. They published, and still do, repair manuals for cars. But Sterling Lanier had read the serialized version of the story in Analog, and when he heard through the grapevine that Frank Herbert was trying to sell the novel rights, he wrote to Frank and offered an advance of $7,500 plus royalties for a hardcover edition. That's the equivalent in 2024 money of just under $75,000, a respectable advance for a novel and, truly, a remarkable investment from a publisher that had only done auto repair manuals up until that point. But Lanier and Chilton made the right call. Despite all the ways it was different from everything else that was out there, particularly in the genre of science fiction, it was a critical success. Reviewers raved about its original ideas and its compelling world-building. It won the first ever Nebula Award and tied with Roger Zelazny's And Call Me Conrad for the Hugo. For all of you who are not sci-fi nerds, let me put that into context for you. Roger Zelazny was and is considered to be one of the greatest writers in the genre. And today, the Hugo and Nebula aren't just the top honors in the genres of speculative fiction, but they're considered to be among the most prestigious literary awards in the entire English-speaking world. This is the equivalent of an unknown novel published by an imprint that usually does car repair manuals, winning the National Book Award, and tying with Vladimir Nabokov for the Pulitzer Prize. It was huge, a huge honor, and it blew back many a wig in the publishing world. Cheers to you, Frank. Despite the critical acclaim and these two major awards, Dune still had a slow takeoff among the wider culture. 3 years after its publication, Frank Herbert's total earnings from Dune, including his advance, barely exceeded $20,000, which is respectable money for the time, but not enough for him to quit his day job. But Dune had garnered enough respect that more doors opened for Frank. By that time, he was living in Seattle, and he got a solid, permanent post on the staff of the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, one of the newspapers there, and then teaching positions at the University of Washington during the early 1970s. And it was then and there, in the early parts of that decade, on the campuses of not just UW, but colleges and high schools around North America, that Dune really found its feet and began to walk, and then to run, on its own. It is not a coincidence that Dune's popularity didn't really take off until the Watergate scandal erupted into the public consciousness. And although the novel wasn't intentionally written to satirize any particular politician, Richard Nixon was a pretty obvious analog for Dune's incredibly powerful and morally corrupt Emperor Shaddam IV, who is magnificently and subtly portrayed in the Villeneuve adaptation by Christopher Walken. Notably, Nixon had already launched the War on Drugs, which purported to be a crusade to protect the physical and moral health of the nation, but in reality was literally just contrived as a way to strip voting rights from the two groups of people whom Nixon hated the most, black people and white liberal students who were very outspoken against the Korean and Vietnam Wars. And by the way, this little tidbit of history is not just me being an obnoxious leftist hating on a conservative president. A few years ago, John Ehrlichman, who served as Nixon's personal assistant, made this admission about the origins of the War on Drugs. This is a direct quote. You want to know what it was really about? The Nixon campaign in 1968 and the Nixon White House after that had two enemies, the anti-war left and black people. You understand what I'm saying? We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or black, but by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and blacks with heroin and then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities. We could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did. End quote. So there you have it, folks. All the suffering and mass incarceration and continued social and economic oppression of black people that has resulted from the war on drugs was all engineered so that Richard fucking Nixon, that asshole, could throw people he didn't like in prison and strip people who tended to vote for liberal candidates of their voting rights by making them into felons. Cool. But that funny resonance between real political things that were happening in the actual world and the themes within the fictional world of Dune merged into a rather loud harmony in the early 70s. It wasn't just the exposure of a thoroughly corrupt power structure. The energy crisis was just kicking off, which really made the metaphor of spice in the novel extra compelling, and the criminalization of psychedelics and prosecution of psychedelics users was a big deal too, since the folks involved in psychedelic counterculture weren't using their drugs to get high. And anyone who has experienced psychedelics will tell you that it's frequently not a fun experience. They were using psychedelics out of a very earnest desire to try to understand what consciousness is, what minds are, and how they work, and what they're really capable of. It's a topic I've explored many times on this podcast in various episodes, usually in the context of talking about artificial intelligence. But this quest to come to grips with consciousness as a phenomenon was severely curtailed by Nixon's war on drugs. And people who found their exploration of the mind stymied by Nixon found a reflection of their own frustrations in the story of Dune. This is when the book really took off in 1973, and it ran like wildfire through the psychedelic underground of the West. Everyone who was a nonconformist was reading Dune. And the ideas that novel contained were finding new homes in all those minds, and Dune itself began to grow far beyond the confines of its own pages.
It is by will alone I set my mind in motion. It is by the juice of Safu that thoughts acquire speed, the lips acquire stains, the stains become a warning. It is by will alone I set my mind in motion. It is by will alone I set my mind in motion. It is by the juice of Safu that thoughts acquire speed, the lips acquire stains, the stains become a warning. It is by will alone I set my mind in motion.
Just 2 years after Dune was published in the United States, another visionary artist was launching his own career in Mexico. Alejandro Jodorowsky was born in Chile, 9 years after Frank Herbert, to Jewish Ukrainian parents who'd fled Europe due to rising anti-Semitism. Alejandro was an unusual boy, intensely interested in esoterica and the occult from a young age, and he was also a natural, what's the art version of a polymath? A dilettante? Maybe that's the right word. Alejandro's interest in the arts was broad and unrestrained. Starting with poetry and literature as a young boy, his passion progressed to theater, and as a young adult, he dropped out of college to become a mime. Historically, not a great career move, but Alejandro made it work. He returned to Europe, to Paris, where he scratched out a living in theater with miming and doing other clown work. His experience with mime landed him a few roles in some experimental French films, which was the genesis of his interest in film as an art form. Throughout the 60s, he dedicated himself to group performance art and bounced between companies in Paris and Mexico City. The performance art groups he worked with specialized in shocking content that very intentionally and aggressively subverted social norms. Now, opinions vary on the utility and artistic merit of these types of performances. I have opinions of my own about such kinds of art, for sure. But during times of extreme and unbalanced social conservatism, as was the case in the late 50s and early 60s, particularly in Mexico, I think shock value art of all kinds has a real purpose and is to be appreciated for what it is, namely, a disruption of the comfort that comes to people who occupy a privileged position in society, to force them to a greater awareness of the real problems that are going on around them below the surface of an otherwise civilized society. In 1968, Alejandro adapted a play written by one of his weird performance art friends into a film. Fondo y Lee was Alejandro's first experiment with filmmaking, and he had absolutely no prior experience with the medium, no knowledge of the technical aspects of filmmaking. He was a total noob who just wanted to make a movie purely for the experience of doing it. Fondo y Lee had pretty much no budget and was shot on weekends when Alejandro and his friends weren't working at their day jobs. He entered the finished film in the Acapulco Film Festival. It was accepted, and then at its screening during the festival, a full-scale riot broke out because it was so subversive, so challenging to social norms, which immediately led to the film being banned all across Mexico. Despite the fact that Fondo Ely was not any kind of financial success, the riot and the banning cemented Alejandro Jodorowsky's reputation forever. Film societies in New York and Paris picked it up for re-editing and dubbing, and it was screened in those cities too. Underwhelming success, but a certain faction of hardcore film buffs really appreciated its weird approach. They liked Alejandro's filmmaking and saw the genuine artistry below his rough, unpracticed approach to the medium. Based on the underground appreciation for Fondo Ely, Alejandro was able to secure just enough of a budget that he could make a good film for a second one. A movie called El Topo, which came out in 1970, showing only at midnight screenings in select theaters across the United States. El Topo had just enough of a budget that its imagery could be haunting and emotionally affecting rather than just kinda goofy, and it quickly became a byword among fans of avant-garde and underground film. In fact, El Topo is still revered to this day among hardcore cinema buffs. It never became a big hit, but it didn't need to be. It only needed to push Alejandro a little farther along his path, move him one step closer to a larger goal. And by that time, Alejandro knew what his goal was. By then, his dilettante tendencies and his broad artistic background had settled into a more singular focus. He would dedicate his life to film, but he didn't want to make blockbusters or pop pieces that would satisfy studio executives. No, from the moment the Acapulco Film Festival had erupted into a riot over his first movie, he'd understood the incredible power the medium of film had. It was the quintessential form of mass communication, the most powerful vehicle for storytelling the world had yet seen. Through film, he could reach and influence the greatest possible number of minds all around the world. Through film, Alejandro could change the world. But it wouldn't be his next film, the one that followed El Topo, that would go forth and reshape the world. First, Alejandro had to lay the proper foundation for his greater work. The film that followed El Topo was called The Holy Mountain, and it's another revered classic among surrealist film buffs, but it's even less coherent than El Topo. The Holy Mountain doesn't really have much of a plot. Instead, it depicts a variety of key occult ideas, including the progression of the major arcana of the tarot, and an initiation ritual into a tradition of practical magic. And I think the Holy Mountain's purpose was, in fact, to be an act of ritual magic. It was, for Alejandro, a powerful act that prepared the way for the great work he was about to produce, a film that would move through the world and change it, alter the way people saw the world and themselves and their roles in this cosmic drama we're all enacting in our day-to-day lives. The film Alejandro really wanted to make was Dune.
Try looking into that place where you dare not look. You will find me there staring back at you.
You mustn't speak!
I'm a big documentary fan. I have been since I was a small child, and I know that's probably fairly weird that a kid would prefer documentaries to cartoons or whatever, but I've always been fascinated by real-life narratives. And some documentarists are really damn good at what they do. They tell an entertaining story. One of my all-time favorite documentaries is called Jodorowsky's Dune, directed by Frank Povich. It used to be free on Netflix, now you have to pay to watch it, but it is so worth it. It tells the story of the greatest movie never made, Alejandro Jodorowsky's ill-fated adaptation of Dune, and what a gripping and fascinating story this is. I'm only going to touch briefly on the broad strokes of this tale in this episode, but I do highly recommend that you check out the documentary Jodorowsky's Dune. I think it's currently on Amazon Prime. And also check out the original score for the documentary, which was composed by Kurt Stenzel. It is awesome. It's just really incredible ambient sci-fi music that makes you feel like you're floating through space. So Alejandro, having come from this background of weird subversive performance art, was pretty tied into the counterculture, as you can imagine, in both North and South America and in Europe. And one of the things he was noticing by the early 70s was that everyone in that counterculture world was reading Dune and loving Dune and talking about Dune. He understood that there was a powerful idea within the story of Dune, an idea that wanted to spread throughout humanity. He understood, too, that the imagery and characters and themes in the novel were speaking to people in urgent and exciting ways. He saw this story as the one he must adapt to film in order to make that powerful thing, that prophet of a movie that would alter the psychological landscape of humanity. But he didn't want to just make an adaptation of the story that was in Frank Herbert's novel. Alejandro wanted to harness the essence of the story and put it to work for him. He didn't want to retell Frank's tale. Frank had already done his work, had already taken what the entity of Dune had given him and put it into the world in his way. Instead, Alejandro wanted to adapt the emotional and intellectual reaction people were having to Frank Herbert's novel and create a unique derivative work, loosely based on Frank's concept, but carrying the work of the story forward in its own unique way. So he very deliberately did not read Dune himself, but instead, he talked to people who had read it. He asked them to tell him everything about the characters, the plot, the themes, the imagery, so the rendition of Dune that he was working with was filtered through the interpretation of other people's minds, not his own mind. I think this is such a fascinating way to interpret a story, and as a novelist myself, I would be so interested to see what a talented filmmaker did with my own stories by filtering them through the minds of fans of my work. I think the resulting product might not have much fidelity to my original story, but it would say something more important, or perhaps more to the point of my story than a straight adaptation ever could. See, by relying on the version of Dune that had already sunk itself into the conscious and subconscious minds of the people who'd read it, Alejandro realized he could get much closer to his actual goal, to make a film that was a prophet. A film that changed the trajectory of civilization. A film that ushered in a new age, a new reality. And with the potent drama of his magical ritual, the Holy Mountain, still ringing in the minds of audiences, he set to work on Dune with great excitement and optimism. Alejandro assembled a team to help him make this film. He needed a storyboard artist to help him create the shot list and designers to get the visuals right, but since he wasn't just making a movie, these couldn't be ordinary artists. They had to share his vision for what a film could be, what this film could be. Alejandro referred to his crew as his warriors. Each of the warriors he chose for his project were unique and visionary in their own ways. They weren't doing things the way other people in the industry said things must be done. They were pursuing their forms of art not because the film industry could be lucrative for them, but because they felt compelled to make real art, to express big ideas that could find no outlet except in film. Some of these exceptional talents, who were little known at the time, even in their own fields, included the special effects artist Dan O'Bannon, illustrator Chris Foss, the artist and writer Jean Giraud, who's better known by his pen name Moebius, and the artist H.R. Giger, who, by the way, has an incredibly fascinating life story of his own, and I might have to do an episode dedicated solely to Giger someday. I won't spoil the documentary for you because I really do think you should watch it if you haven't already, but fortune turned against Alejandro and his warriors, in part because Alejandro's vision for the production was just too big. Both the projected runtime and the budget kept growing to wildly overblown proportions. Back then, in 1973, it was tremendously expensive to produce even the simplest of visual effects, and Alejandro knew that Dune had to be as big and imposing and powerful as the idea itself was, as the psychic residue was that had extracted itself from the novel and implanted itself with such obvious fervor in the minds of so many people. He would not and could not scale this film down. A scaled-down version couldn't change the world. It could never be a prophet. And so, after a few years of work on the early stages of the production, the studio that had bankrolled the project took it out of Alejandro's hands and gave it instead to a bewildered and overwhelmed David Lynch, who did the best he could with Alejandro's bizarre, occultic mess. That's how we got the first film adaptation of Dune, which is so abysmally terrible that every Dune fan has a certain fondness for its campy goofiness. But that wasn't the end of the story for Jodorowsky's adaptation. And it wasn't the end of the story for Dune, either. For by that time, the fandom for the novel Dune had only continued to grow, and Alejandro is no slouch as a magician. The ritual he presented to the world in the form of the Holy Mountain was doing its work in the world. It was Alejandro's will to create a film that would change the world. But magic is a funny thing, and egregores are funny things. Like the great worm of Arrakis, Shai Hulud, if you can manage to get on and keep yourself upright, you can ride on an egregore's back. But you're not in charge of where the worm is going.
I must not fear. Fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little death that brings total obliteration.
After Alejandro's crew was disbanded, they went on to work on other sci-fi film projects for other studios. But they carried with them all the imagery and all the ideas they'd cooked up together while they'd worked on Alejandro's doomed film. And before the studio was able to pawn it off on David Lynch, Alejandro's storyboards were sent to every major film studio in Hollywood where producers and directors looked them over. And there is no way for me to adequately convey the strangeness and amazingness of what happened next in audio format because film is such a visual medium. You truly have to watch the documentary, Jodorowsky's Dune, to appreciate how striking this effect is. But for now, you'll just have to believe me when I tell you that exact images from Alejandro's storyboards leapt off of those pages and into the minds of everyone who considered producing his film. And the images stayed there and repeated throughout the entire genre of science fiction. Exact duplicates of shots in nearly every major work of sci-fi cinema from the late 1970s on. Star Wars, Terminator, Alien and all its sequels, the list goes on. As Alejandro's warriors spread through the industry of sci-fi cinema, they found new homes for the things they'd created for Dune. The very distinctive style of H.R. Giger in particular is all over modern sci-fi cinema, and is most evident in Alien, particularly in the design of the alien itself with its elongated head and weird pseudo-mechanical body parts. These little-known virtual nobodies who were chosen to work with Alejandro not because they had great reputations yet, but because they were spiritual people who understood the potential power of film and of story, they became the biggest names in their professions, and their work totally remade the visual style and the narrative purpose of science fiction. Alejandro's Dune was not going to be stopped just because the studio had taken it away from him. It no longer needed Alejandro himself. The magician who had brought that egregore to life was disposable now. The film that would be a prophet had moved beyond Alejandro to seed itself into the cinematic world, where it began altering the landscape to suit its own purposes. Dune the Egregore had taken control of sci-fi itself and was restructuring it, laying its own groundwork, making plans of its own for a future only it could see.
And how can this be? For he is the Kwisatz Haderach!
By the time several of Alejandro's warriors had won Oscars for their work on Alien in 1979, a Quebecois boy by the name of Denis Villeneuve was 12 years old and already crazy about sci-fi. He was captivated by the visuals and the ideas of the genre, by their grand scope and their epic, mythological feel, by the political and social themes he was just beginning to grasp in the most tenuous of ways. He had read the novel Dune, as most nerdy sci-fi boys had by the late 1970s, and found a deep, resonant inspiration in the story of Paul Atreides, a boy not much older than himself, who's forced into the role of Messiah. Denis had no idea that the sci-fi he knew, the films he now saw on movie screens, had already been utterly changed by Dune, altered from the campy adventure stories the genre had mainly focused on prior to Denis' birth, and altered especially by the ill-fated version of one former mime-turned-magician who had conducted a public ritual to turn reels of celluloid into prophetic power. All Denis knew was that sci-fi was fucking cool, and he loved it, and when he grew up, he wanted to make movies just like the movies he loved to watch. The first movie he planned to make was Dune. He and his friend Nicolas Cadama, both 13 at the time, entertained themselves by drafting their own storyboards and screen adaptations of Frank Herbert's novel. It was play, but it was also something bigger than that. Dune the Egregore had found its own warrior, had raised Denis up on a diet of sci-fi that looked the way Dune wanted to look, that carried the weight Dune wanted to carry. When David Lynch's frustrating and disjointed adaptation of Dune came out in 1984, Denis was 17 years old and more smitten with Frank Herbert's novel than ever before. He was sorely disappointed with Lynch's adaptation, although, to be fair, I think no one was more disappointed with it than Lynch was himself, and he couldn't help thinking of those old storyboards he'd made with Nicholas years before. He was just a kid, but he knew he already had better ideas for a Dune adaptation than anyone else had had. And if he played his cards right, then someday he might be able to give his favorite novel the adaptation it deserved. Denis' career as a film director started slowly, as is the case for most great artists. By the time he was in his early 30s, his debut movie, in the science fiction genre, of course, premiered at the Cannes Film Festival, but never really went beyond that. But little by little, he built on each small success until his quiet reputation for artistic excellence landed him in the director's chair for Blade Runner 2049, which, I have to say, is one of the most visually spectacular and emotionally momentous works of science fiction I've ever encountered in any medium. Blade Runner 2049 hadn't even come out yet, it was still being edited, when Denis took a shot in the dark. He knew Blade Runner 2049 was something special, that it would strike audiences in Hollywood with a sense of real power. Now was the time to try to live up to that old original dream, to turn his childhood storyboards into a real movie. He had laid the groundwork with a strong career of well-regarded, well-made films, even if none of them were yet massive hits. And a different kind of groundwork had been laid, too. By then, it was the mid-2010s. Technology had advanced considerably since the 1970s. It was much more affordable than ever before to produce jaw-dropping special effects on a relatively slim budget. Plus, the genre of science fiction had taken on a new tone. It had shed the over-the-top melodrama of the original Star Trek and films like Flash Gordon, fun, but not to be taken seriously, and had donned a cloak of somber, intense introspection. Sci-fi was no longer about pew-pew laser guns and starship battles with Martians. Now, potential futures were mirrors to be held up to humanity, to reflect the real problems of the real world, exactly as Frank Herbert had done with his 1965 novel. When Denis proposed his next project to the studio, an ambitious, visually stunning, two-part adaptation of Dune, which has now grown to three parts, he got the green light. Even though a green light for a project as huge as this one, and a story as burdened by failed adaptations as this one was, well, that was a very unlikely outcome. Blade Runner 2049 would go on to be a big box office success, but that hadn't happened yet. Denis Villeneuve was still the directorial equivalent of a mid-list author, not unlike yours truly. A solid performer with a respectable body of work, but he hadn't blown any wigs back yet. But none of that mattered. What mattered was that the time was right. The world was in a state of crisis, the culture in desperate need of a mirror to see its problems more clearly, and a new era was crying out for a prophet to lead those who had eyes to see and those who had ears to hear out of the darkness into a new kind of light. Dune, the idea, the egregore, had not only waited for the right moment to transform itself into a new shape, a more vital shape than the dying medium of the printed novel. Dune the Egregore had taken control of science fiction itself, had remade its own substrate to suit its purposes better, and had raised up its champion on the kind of sci-fi that Dune itself wanted to be. Patiently, with the long-term vision that only ideas can have, it bided its time until the right audience could receive its message and absorb its ideas into a new generation of humanity. An audience that would be empowered enough and awake enough, the way Paul is awakened by the spice, to understand the importance of the message itself. And now, just when humanity is technologically advanced enough to present the critical message carried inside Dune with its full majesty and import, just when humanity is aware enough of its own shortcomings and has enough collective will to actually do something, to act on the message rather than merely meditate on it, now, Dune has come forth, the way it was meant to be experienced. And Denis Villeneuve's film adaptations have been huge hits. Even with Part 1 coming out in the midst of the pandemic, it still rocked the film industry and captivated an entire new generation of fans. Its message is now moving through the culture in a form that's right for this culture. In the 60s, when Frank Herbert wrote Dune, everyone was reading novels. Nowadays, more people watch movies. That pains me to admit as a novelist, but it is true. Dune continues to find ever larger groups of minds to inhabit. It's not the kind of idea that's going to die off with its creator. It has a bigger job to do in this world. And I'm glad it has found its way from mere book to actual egregore, an actual autonomous idea, because the maximum number of people need to receive Dune's message right now, urgently. See, Dune is a story that's easy to misinterpret if you just take a cursory pass at it, if you see what's obviously right there on the surface and don't look any deeper than that. You'll see that clear analogy between spice and oil and you'll say, aha, it's about how destructive and exploitative the fossil fuel industry is. And that's true, that's part of the story, but it's so much bigger than that. Here's what sci-fi author Devin Erickson said recently on Twitter. I can't phrase it any better myself, so I'm just gonna quote Devin's entire long tweet about it. Alright, here it is. It's astonishing how few people understood Dune. It's as if they cannot reconcile the concepts of a good man and a bad outcome existing together. This is the whole point of Dune. It is a cautionary tale about the merging of church and state, about the dangers of cults of personality, of idolatry. If you think Paul is bad, you've missed the whole point of the story, which is that structures of power have a life of their own, and they constrain those who wield that power. If Paul were bad, then the possibility would remain that placing a good man in his position would lead to a good outcome. But because Paul is not bad, we are able to see the implication that Paul's position, not Paul's character, is what leads to the numerous bad outcomes of the books. Being prescient, he sees this, and much of the story of him and his heir, Leto II, is devoted to his struggle, not against external enemies, but the constraints of his own power and position and legend. The golden path is a dimly glimpsed thread of possibility whereby a good outcome for humanity can eventually be achieved, but it will come about as the result of the destruction of everything that Paul and Leto have built. The fact that they strive for that outcome is a testament to their moral character. This is why Tolkien hated Dune. It was a direct contradiction of the basic authoritarian theme of Lord of the Rings. In Lord of the Rings, power is simple. It is wielded by a central authority and all must kneel. The only question is whether it is to be an evil authority or a good one, Sauron or the true king who has returned. There is no notion of a bureaucracy which has its own influence and character, nor is there any notion of bad outcomes for good intent, no notion that the world is complex, that outcomes are hard to judge, that suffering might arise from mistake as easily as from malice. Just find noble king, place on throne, done. In Dune, Paul is the noble king, and the evil of his rule arises not from Paul the man, but from the institution of kingship itself. End quote. Dune is an egregore, an idea that moves under its own power, and Dune is about egregores. About the way power structures become their own entities, about the way idolatry and messiah worship become their own entities that outstrip the influence and the control of the messiah himself. Dune is a cautionary tale about right now, about this moment of rising fascism when powerful but faceless entities like capitalism, empire, and organized religion are all warring for control over masses of oppressed everymen like you and me. It's about the way the elevation of one person as a savior figure will always lead to that person's fascistic rule over the masses, the way authoritarianism never ends well for the greater number of human beings. Dune is about the way power becomes its own creature and seeks to fortify and expand itself just for the sake of doing so. It's about the way power does indeed exceed the ability of the powerful to control it. An egregore about egregores, brought to life by a magic ritual performed by a man who desperately wanted to spread a prophetic message that would wake the world up to its own reality and show the greatest possible number of people some alternative way of dealing with power, of ordering our societies, of moving through reality. Being a huge fan of the book, I have a certain fondness for the previous adaptations. I enjoy them for what they are. The David Lynch film is super campy and ridiculous, but it's a classic of sci-fi cinema, and it's got Sting in purple Speedos knife-fighting Kyle MacLachlan. I mean, what's not to love about that?
I will kill him!
Pause!
I will kill him!
But really, it's a shitty movie. It's a bad movie that you love anyway, because you can't help but admire that it was trying. The miniseries created by the Sci-Fi Channel in the mid-2000s is a very admirable adaptation that really does a great service to the story that you'll find in the novel. But it suffered from a small budget, and even if it had had a large enough budget to do it justice, the technology just wasn't there at the time to replicate Frank Herbert's vision on a believable scale. Dune was ever only going to get a truly worthy adaptation now, in the 2020s, after the tone of sci-fi itself was altered by Alejandro Jodorowsky's aborted attempt at adapting Dune. It wouldn't have been technologically or socially possible to bring this creation to life until now, until Dune itself had already changed the landscape and the tone of sci-fi cinema to suit its purposes, until it had the chance to nurture a visionary creator on its own milk. Denis Villeneuve was and is Dune's right hand, its faithful servant, and he did a remarkable job. The two films taken together are damn near perfect. I have no complaints about Villeneuve's adaptation, primarily because it does such an apt job of communicating the true theme of the story, which is, as Devin Erickson pointed out, an indictment of fascism and of the Messiah myths that lead inevitably to fascism. And although he has never said so in any interview that I'm aware of, I know that Villeneuve also knows that he didn't just make his own film. He made Alejandro Jodorowsky's film, too. Villeneuve's Dune is Jodorowsky's Dune. You know how I know that? Think back to the very first trailers that came out advertising the first part of Villeneuve's adaptation back when we were all in lockdown in 2020. Maybe it was early 2021. I can't remember when the trailer came out. But the trailer featured the outro to the Pink Floyd album, Dark Side of the Moon. It's a song called Eclipse, even though no Pink Floyd appears anywhere in either of the two films themselves. But Jodorowsky had originally planned to have Pink Floyd score his film, and he specifically cited the album, Dark Side of the Moon, with its intensely esoteric themes as his reason for choosing the band. Villeneuve put the outro to Dark Side of the Moon into the original trailer as a message to Jodorowsky and, I believe, to the egregore of Dune itself. The message was clear to those of us who are super-duper nerdy about Dune and its fascinating esoteric history. Here it is, Denis was saying with that trailer. It's done. We've done it together. It lives now, the way it has always wanted to live, and it will go on living long after the rest of us are gone.
Chicken, we need a little ride. We need a lot for the gumbo tonight.
That's all I've got for you today. Thank you so much for listening. I'll be back in 3 weeks on April 17th with a really cool episode I'm super excited about. I'll have another interview / freewheeling conversation for you with a very interesting writer whose nonfiction book I recently enjoyed, and I'm thrilled that she has agreed to come on the show and chat with me. Until then, if you've been enjoying Future Saint of a New Era, please make sure you've subscribed on your favorite podcast app, and if you listen on Apple Podcasts, take a moment to rate and review, since that allows me to call the great Shai Hulud of the algorithm and ride it to more curious weirdos like you. Music was from the motion picture soundtrack to David Lynch's Dune, composed by Steve Porcaro and David Paich. Sound collage components were also from David Lynch's Dune, so remember to keep your hand in the box and awaken your personal sleeper. Outro music is Run in the Mardi Gras by Boko, used with permission of Big Crown Records. For more information about this podcast, including socials and ways to contact me, visit futuresaintpod.com. I'm Libby Grant, and until next time, do good magic and make good worlds.